We were the first to do the limited lifetime warranty, which was a big deal. People thought we were crazy at the time. But what's great about that warranty is it keeps us honest. It's a mechanism to force us to make sure we build good products that do have quality control.
And so we've had a pass on designs, especially some of the early Gen 3, because just the nature of the design would make it to where you couldn't create a quality product. Like, that product is going to break.
And so what's been very interesting about this whole hyper paddle phenomenon is you have people that are like, oh man, these guys were at the pinnacle of technology, like they're doing all this and that, and but then everyone's really pissed that their product's falling apart. And then you have that same brand within a year, basically their main emphasis is, we went back to QC, we did durability. So even though they're acting like it was a top performance, they obviously from a consumer standpoint had major issues. We don't want a defect to be a feature. Like, yeah, we want to actually build a purposeful feature that actually holds up over time.
What's up, guys, and welcome back to the Pickleball Connection podcast. I'm Janae.
And I'm Barrett.
And we are stoked to be hanging out with you guys today. Today, we have a really special guest with us. We have the co-founders of Selkirk Sport. So I don't want to waste any time, and we are going to roll right into it. Mike and Rob, as you guys both kind of look back on your life and the journey that's brought you to building this amazing company that we all know as Selkirk Sport today, what do you feel like sparked your initial love for building a business?
I mean, we got into business when we were really young.
Yeah.
So I was 17, Mike was 15. We started our airsoft company as a school project, basically, in the basement. I mean, if you really, really rewind, we basically worked for our dad when he was building a couple houses. He was a fireman and he built our house. And we would get like $3 an hour to clean up stuff, and we saved all that money. I think we got like $1,500 over the years. And then we actually put that money in the stock market and then made some money there and then a little bit. And then we started the Raptors Airsoft when 1750, and we did some other stuff. So we were always pretty entrepreneurial, when we were young.
I think our dad always encouraged us to be entrepreneurial, and there weren't any really barriers or expectations that we had to go to college and follow a career path. So we were always just trying things. We tried a lot of, even before Airsoft, we tried a lot of little different businesses here and there. And it was just fun for us. So it's been one of those things where really, even now what we're doing with Selkirk, it's always been fun. And that's what drives us.
We've technically never had a job. We've never worked for anybody.
Yeah.
Well, the free labor, really.
Yeah. We've worked for our dad quite a bit.
We worked for our dad.
Speaking of your dad, I remember him like recounting the story of the first time that you guys sent a payment overseas, like in your basement. How old were you guys at that point? And this, I think, was with the airsoft business.
18?
Maybe 15 or 16. But just before that, we were airsoft players. And so we were like, hey, we're doing this. Let's find a way to make a little bit of a business out of it. And so we started by finding local distributors and drop shipping on eBay and Amazon. And we thought we were doing good. You know, the price was $50. We were selling it for $20. We thought we were making $5. Eventually you realize like, oh, in business, there's a lot of other costs. And
even when you're in your dad's basement.
Right, yeah. And so we started just trying to look around for other ways of sourcing product, and we discovered Alibaba. And at the time, Alibaba was just kind of getting started. It wasn't as well known of a platform.
Pretty sketch at the time.
Yeah. There's some suppliers that were scams, some that weren't. But we eventually found a supplier directly from China. We're like, hey, let's buy directly from here, and then we could sell it on eBay and Amazon. So we basically were doing a direct-to-consumer strategy, but we didn't even know what that was at the time. We found a supplier. We sent over $3,000 for PO.
That was most of our money.
Yeah, that was basically all of our savings.
Yeah.
And Our dad didn't think it was going to arrive.
He didn't think it was going to show up.
But
he probably prepped you like, this might not come back.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah, for sure.
And it was little parts too. So we basically get this DHL box, like probably like that.
Yeah.
It's all wrapped up and it arrived. And then we put every dime back in. Yeah.
So basically what we've done our entire life is with the airsoft parts, we would buy them, we would resell them, and then we would take all the money and put it back into the business. And so even as Selkirk, we've never had investors. We've always just been bootstrapped.
Wow. Yeah. It's pretty unusual, even like hearing this story about high schoolers, like taking such big risks at young age. And I even see like big risk taking later on. So like, what is it about you guys that is very willing to take such big risks?
I think we've always been about controlled risk. So like, if you think about what was the worst case scenario, if we failed, we're still in our dad's basement, right? So like, you know, we didn't have families, so I actually look at it as a huge blessing that, and I encourage people when they're super young, like do those things when you're young. Cause when you're 40, like you can still do them, but it's hard when you have a family and you have responsibilities and a mortgage. And so we didn't have any of that. So, I mean, it was a risk, but it was, you know, we were going to be pretty much back into the same position no matter what. So it, you know, and I do think we're naturally risk takers, but we've always tried to be pretty controlled risk takers and be wise how we hedge our bets to make sure we're, do it in a controlled manner, I guess is a good way to put it.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. A lot of times when others perceive us taking a big risk, it doesn't feel like a big risk to us because we'll do a lot of experiments. We'll think through it. What we're often doing, what just makes the most logical sense, but it just is usually contrarian to what else is happening in the market. So it seems like a big risk, but we're usually pretty convinced at the time that it's going to work. And so it doesn't feel as big of a risk to us.
Yeah. I mean, you even see that through just our short history as a brand. Like, well, I guess we've been around 10 years at this point, but, you know, we had very little sponsored players. In the early days, we had like Tyson and like a handful others, mostly advocates really. And I remember we would bug the crap out of a lot of our competitors because they're like, I'm spending 10% of my revenue on these athletes. You seem to be growing a lot faster. You have one guy. And really what we did was we, especially with you on the marketing side, we leveraged social media, which was just kind of really coming online from a business perspective. Like, there was still a really high ROI in that, like with Facebook and Instagram and all that. And we were leveraging our athletes. So people actually knew who we had versus just throwing money. Cause there was no TV. There was no media distribution for watching pickleball. Like it was basically the US Open once a year and maybe national. And that, you know, with Rusty and pickleball, you know, channel or whatever. Mm-hmm. So we saw that the advantage at that time was to have those athletes and then leverage them from a social media perspective. And then we did that for a while. And then you noticed basically the TV side was gaining tons of traction with PPA. And then we switched on a dime and we became the largest sponsor across the board. And people were like, what the heck is going on? And we basically flipped the script and that worked really well for us. And now we're kind of going the other direction a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. We feel like we're always sort of a little bit swimming upstream or going against the crowd, especially like the marketing decisions is a good example of that. Usually where we spend our focus is on doing things that others aren't doing. So like we were the first ones to focus on social media and then everybody eventually poured into that. And so we switched focus to like, hey, instead of just our own social media, let's also start sponsoring influencers. We were really the first ones to do that. But then eventually everybody recognizes that and floods into that market. And then we have to find something new. So like we've, you know, we're one of the only brands that actually does TV deals, network TV deals, because it makes sense to us and the numbers are there and we see a benefit, but, and it's something that's a little bit of a blue ocean. So we're always searching for those blue ocean strategies.
So it sounds like the airsoft business was pretty successful. So what kind of led you to shift from airsoft and kind of go all in on pickleball? What kind of led to that decision?
Basically to set the landscape, we had started, the airsoft business, I think 09, probably.
I know we were talking about this earlier. I think it's a little bit later because if I was 15, it would have been like.
Was it 10?
Well, maybe it would have been.
Yeah, 09, 10, 2010. We started that. We ran that for a couple of years, pretty much the exact same time we started playing pickleball at the Croc Center, which was just built, and it was walking distance from our house. So we would all go there. We were actually playing basketball. We've told the story in a couple formats, but we were playing basketball with their dad, basically. And he had played the game before, and he saw it getting set up. It was literally the first day they had ever set it up. And my dad's like, that's a fun game, and actually still a good friend to this day, and actually the one that actually designs a lot of our interiors, Selena, came over and said, you guys want to play with me? And so we went over there. They had wood paddles, kind of a crappy net, and we played pickleball. So we fell in love with the sport first, and we were doing that while we were working. And then we were both, you know, I had just gotten married in 2013. And in 2013, we started talking about, we just loved the game, and there just wasn't equipment that met our standards at the end of the day. And it was a very garage, you know, mom and pop feel of a sport at the time. There's a couple big brands, but even they were kind of corny. And Paltech was just kind of emerging at that time, really that year. And so we just saw an opportunity of being able to build a brand. You know, we wanted to build the best product, but also actually a brand in the space. So we started looking into that. Our dad had just retired from the fire department at the time. We started basically kind of doing a research, what would it take to build the product, and founded Selkirk in 2014. But we were avid players. Like even the building we leased for our airsoft business, we had enough space. We put a court in right away. Like that was before even Selkirk. So we've been players since like 2009, 2010 in pickleball. So
yeah, and then we ran airsoft and Selkirk in parallel for a little while. And airsoft was actually doing better than Selkirk. But because we were players and we saw the sport, we just knew like this is going to be big someday. It was very small at the time. Most people hadn't even heard of pickleball, but we just decided, you know what, we're going to sell airsoft even though it's doing better than pickleball, and just go all in on Selkirk. And yeah, and it definitely paid off. It's interesting.
But it was a risk at the time.
It was definitely a risk.
I even remember having a conversation with my wife. I'm like, we're risking a lot doing this. So going back to your risk question, like, That was a calculated risk that we were pretty nervous about, but we just saw how people got addicted when they played, how the community in the industry we were in wasn't like, there were some great people, but it wasn't, you know, like it wasn't people I'd let my kid hang around with. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
And so what was great about pickleball is like, it was a family activity. You could have your family around. We felt like our kids could grow up in this environment, and basically they have. Like I have an 11-year-old who's basically all he's ever known is Selkirk, you know, has been in the family, and he's been to tournaments, and Mike's kids too. And so it's been kind of a cool family experience overall. Yeah.
We have lots of pictures with all of our kids, you know, 2 years old hitting the ball around.
Oh my gosh.
If anyone's ever, you know, started a business, people know that it's not uncommon for entrepreneurs to experience challenges early on. So could you tell us a little bit about what were some kind of those difficult challenges or phases, pivotal moments that you kind of had to overcome in the initial start?
Every day.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a lot of ups and downs, and generally, you know, the first 5 years are the toughest. And we definitely saw that. I mean, early on when we first started Selkirk, we had one employee. So working on some of the production. So we've literally done pretty much every job within our company at one point or another, whether it was customer service, marketing, shipping and receiving, actual production. We've done a little bit of everything. So I think early on, I mean, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of learning, but it was just constantly doing things we haven't done before. So that's something we've become very accustomed to. It's just, you know, we have a new challenge. Okay, we'll just have to jump in and figure it out.
I mean, the challenges still hit us every day, right? Obviously we're a lot bigger now, and we have other people that can tackle, which is nice, but, I mean, it's kind of the famous saying, right? It took 10 years to be an overnight success. So,
Yeah. And I think probably one of the most difficult challenge was during COVID.
Yeah.
Because essentially, I mean, at first we were like, okay, you know, maybe some areas will shut down and some will stay open, but the entire country and world really shut down overnight, and we saw our sales drop 70% overnight. And that's, I mean, if anybody that's been in business knows, that's not sustainable. Like, so we had, thankfully we acted really quick. We were able to do it in a way that still supported our employees. But that was the most difficult time, because we essentially, I think at the time we had maybe 30 employees.
We had to lay off everyone except for, I think, one person.
Yeah, yeah. So essentially what we did was we laid everyone off so they could collect unemployment. But in Idaho, the way the rules are is they can work up to 10 hours and get paid and still collect full unemployment. So we were able to essentially allow people to work 10 hours, pay them a little bit to keep some things running, and then they were able to receive their full paycheck.
Yeah. And that was and that wasn't everyone. Like, production couldn't do that because of the state.
Right, yes, route, yeah. There's some more of the office positions. Yeah. So we kind of went back to doing everything during that time.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
I was early shipping. I was shipping, helping grip paddles. My dad was building all the paddles. Well, one thing that was a huge blessing at the time, we had actually overbuilt before COVID hit. So we had like a ton of inventory pre-built. Okay. So basically we didn't have to, dad was just building stuff that filled holes. I would grip. Our wives came and helped a lot too. So they would come and help build. Mike was doing a lot of customer service and having to deal with a lot of, just other stuff, you know, the day-to-day stuff. So it was pretty bizarre. Like, we were listening to podcasts and it was empty when we had 30 people. Wow. So
yeah, it was pretty surreal. Cause I think we drove to work when everything was shut down and nobody was on the roads, and we'd show up and just
bizarre.
Go to our little warehouse.
It was probably one of the most bizarre times in our lives, just like kind of, I think for a lot of people, but you know, thankfully God's always been there for us. And every time we've hit a challenge, you know, we've just been very blessed that he's protected us and we've gone through it and we just keep plugging along. So,
Yeah, it's pretty amazing actually to make it as a small business through that year, I think, especially in a startup phase. I know that when you guys kind of entered into the pickleball market, most of the paddles were wooden at that point, probably really low quality.
It was kind of half and half, okay.
Yeah.
What did you guys receive any pushback? Because you guys really came in and you started using a lot of new materials that the pickleball scene hadn't really even started using before, whether that was fiberglass or graphite. Did you receive a lot of pushback for kind of pushing the needle in some of the research and development and new materials when it came to making paddles?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's hard for people that have come in more recent years to imagine what pickleball was like, but it was a completely different industry back then. Again, we kind of talked about very, very mom and pop. And there's just a few brands, and the common way of going about things with paddles was just try a few from some of your local dealers or people that have a paddle, and then one you like, you go out and buy. Mm-hmm. So we were the first ones to actually create new technology and say, hey, we did this and we think it's better than what came before. And we had a lot of pushback that we were being arrogant. Like, how can you claim your paddles are better? Again, that's so bizarre in today's world because that's
everybody's all, like, everything's the best.
Yeah, right. Like, everything is, the top of the charts across the board. So we did receive a lot of pushback. I mean, one of the things early on that we changed in the industry was just the language. So early on, the athletes were called players. Like, nobody called them an athlete. Then we went to our small group of players and said, hey, we're going to start calling you guys athletes now. They're like, athletes? Oh, man.
They're like, that's a lot of pressure, guys.
Right. Yeah. Technology wasn't a word used. Like, people would just say materials. And we said, like, no, this is.
It didn't market their technology and what it did either. I mean, the biggest one that really put us on the scene was the Amped in 2017. So that was the one that really, when we launched that, we had a thicker core. We had the thickest core at the time. We implemented, like, we tweaked the core. We had, we tweaked the face. And we built something that was kind of the power and control paddle at the time. We really clearly marketed it. We had a very clear grid system. And so it was just very easy to pick a product. And that put us massive. We were already probably the number one brand, number one, number two at the time. And then that put us clearly in front. And then basically we've been able to kind of hold that position ever since.
Yeah. Hey guys, real quick. I did just want to take a minute to mention Selkirk's newly released Court Strike and Court Strike Pro pickleball shoes. The reason I love these pickleball shoes so much is because they were specifically designed and engineered just for pickleball. Now, shoes I was kind of playing with in the past were made for tennis or other racket sports, or I even made the kind of amateur and rookie mistake for a while to play pickleball in tennis shoes. And honestly, that just didn't end well. So the fact that these shoes were so thoughtfully designed for pickleball. It was really comforting to me. Not only that, they're really comfortable out of the box and they provide great lateral support for that lateral movement that we all need in pickleball. So if you're interested in getting yourself some of the new CourtStrike or CourtStrike Pro pickleball shoes, head over to selkirk.com and get your favorite color in your size today.
Kind of recounting even the journey of pickleball and Selkirk, what year about was it when pickleball really exploded as a sport, and how did that affect you guys in Selkirk?
I think there was an explosion early on, probably 2014, 2015, okay, where it exploded in some of the senior communities in Arizona and Florida. Mm-hmm. So that was the first big growth, and then you saw pickleball steadily accelerating since then. The second big explosion was during the pandemic. So everything shut down. But what we kind of saw early on was nets and beginner paddles sold out across
the industry. Yeah, it was crazy. Everywhere. You couldn't find them.
Because everybody wanted to buy a net and put it in their backyard because they could have an activity that they could do. And so probably the last half of 2020, we started seeing things really pick up again. And it exploded, not just in the senior communities this time, but actually with a larger demographic. So since 2020, there's been a huge demographic shift where the younger crowd is actually more of the growth than previous. So it's interesting, because pickleball used to have a perception that it was a senior sport. Mm-hmm. And even when we would go to tournaments, we were always the youngest
people would stare at us, man.
Yeah.
They're like, what are you doing here?
We were the youngest by 30 years.
Yeah,
almost
it was
always.
Crazy. But every year we would see the demographic come down 5-10 years. It was pretty, right. It was pretty crazy.
I remember the first time we told someone, a friend, that we were in pickleball, and they're like, oh, that's the sport that all the young people are playing on Instagram. And I just thought that was interesting because it's like, it's the first time I've heard someone characterize pickleball that way,
right.
Which was pretty
cool.
Because
that's when you guys got in, right? Was around 2020-ish?
We actually started playing in 2019.
Yeah, 2019. Okay, so you got in a little earlier.
We were there when it wasn't cool.
Yeah.
2019, it was, we were still kind of some of the younger crowd. And then really over the last couple years is when we started to see more and more
It's crazy.
Now at our local parks and even at a local indoor facility, there's young, youth, I'm 13, 14 year olds, training. And it's pretty amazing to see, because we didn't ever think that all of our friends were the same way. You guys that's an old person's.
Yeah. What are you doing with your life?
Yeah. I mean, we experienced that early on. When we both got married, our father-in-laws weren't too sure about what we were doing with our life. People in general, right?
Mine was pretty good. He kind of knew, but yours was kind of what are you doing?
Yeah. Yeah.
But even going back to your challenges question, Mike mentioned the COVID, but one thing that was always a struggle was any business knows when you grow really fast, that's a huge strain because you could even be profitable or you could even be doing well. But if you're having to scale, your workforce scale, buy inventory scale, everything, that's a huge strain. And so growth kills businesses too. And so we've had to manage, pretty much constantly through our company's existence, at least a minimum of 40% growth per year, and multiple times triple digit growth. So
that's crazy to hear.
Yeah, we had years where we were doing more in a year than we had that year than we had previously our entire company's history to that point. So that type of growth is just very, very challenging.
It's very volatile.
Very volatile. It's just stressful. It's stressful on your team. It's stressful, on you, and it's just it's a huge blessing, right? So it's you're whining about growth, but there was many times when we were growing that I was like, man, this could get, especially early on, this could go south really, really quick.
Yeah.
So, and we thankfully it didn't. So
yeah. And so this is actually kind of a good segue into where we wanted to go from here. We did start playing in 2019. At that time, within the last 6 years, we've kind of seen hundreds of brands kind of start to, really within the last couple years, we've seen hundreds of brands kind of start to flood the space. But what we noticed is that a lot of these brands seemed to be kind of buying the same paddles from China and slapping their logo on it. So I wanted to ask you guys, has it been important and why has it been a place of emphasis for Selkirk to kind of emphasize USA made products?
Yeah, so we have USA manufacturing capabilities. I believe you guys are doing some videos along those lines as well. And so that's always been important to us from the beginning. And at this point, like, there's a lot of capabilities across the globe. So we will either make something in the USA, we'll assemble it in the USA, or we'll do quality control in the USA for some of our SLK products. But the fact that we actually know how to build products makes a big difference when we're designing paddles, when we're working with overseas partners. I mean, an example of this, have some friends that worked in Boeing back in the day when they actually made airplanes. And then they, early 2000s, they adopted a strategy of outsourcing. So they basically said, we're no longer a manufacturer of airplanes, we're an integrator. And so they outsourced their manufacturing globally to companies that oftentimes didn't even deal with that product. And they thought they were just going to snap the planes together back in the US. And it was one of those things where all the management consultants thought it was brilliant at the time, but 10, 15 years later, people realized like that was a huge mistake for Boeing, and they're still regretting it.
Well, and their CEO was an engineer too. Earlier days, they had the engineer CEOs, so they knew how to build stuff. And then
then eventually they came in with finance CEOs who were more about the financial engineering rather than what's doing best for the company. So that's just sort of like a tale of
coming off
of yeah. Yeah. So that's just sort of a tale of what it looks like when you have those manufacturing capabilities and you outsource everything overseas. So we do some outsourcing, but the fact that we're always going to retain some paddles that are made in the USA gives us a huge leg up compared to our competitors.
Right. And too, I mean, I think you went through with Tom, like, we're vertically integrating so much on the, especially from an R&D perspective, where we're just controlling the entire process to be able to make sure at the end of the day, we are building the highest performance product. Because going back to your, like, mentioning how many brands came in, I mean, when we got in, the major brands, these were the major brands, was ProLite, Onyx, or S-Type. They were known as S-Type, that they changed their name to Onyx. So, like, our very first paddle was an S-Type, basically. And then Paddle Tech was, like, roaring onto the scene. And then us. That was, like, it.
Just four.
Like, there was more, but, like, that was...
I forgot about
it. Yeah, they were big, man. Yeah. They were...
I mean, they were ProLite and Pickleball Inc., actually.
Yeah. Oh, Pickleball Inc., sorry.
So the biggest brands, I think, were ProLite and Pickleball Inc. at the time.
Yeah.
And Paddle Tech was an up-and-comer.
And well, and Onyx moved a lot of volume.
And S-Type was doing well. And actually, this is something we talk about a lot, is we see our competitors change about every 3 years who we're competing with. We've been one of the few brands that have been able to actually adapt and last. Because early on, like, yeah, there's ProLite and Pickleball Inc. And then Pickleball Inc. was bought and they kind of crashed.
Yeah, they didn't adjust.
Right, because they were definitely the big dog when we first got in.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the brands we were worried about, do you remember Manta?
Yeah, there was Manta, Canadian brand.
Yeah, we thought they were going to do well. Yeah,
yeah, there's like, that's why when people always are like, oh man, are you worried about this and that? And I'm like, we're worried about different people because we know what it takes to have longevity in this sport.
Yeah.
So the brands you think we're worried about, there may be some, but we actually have other, I mean, we had that in our company meeting, right? Like we're worried about certain brands because we know they're building infrastructure, not because they just had a one hit wonder, right?
Yeah.
Those brands come and go pretty quick.
Because when you guys first got in, like, Electrum was sort of the hot up and coming brand.
It was
at the time.
It was revolutionary spin, you know, we could go into that, but it's obsolete now.
Are they even around anymore?
They are. Yeah, but they're one like we were never really worried about because their mindset was to outsource in everything. So they didn't have offices. Like, everything was done by a third party. So it's like you can't build a business that way. And also, like, there's I mean, that was one of the early issues with spin being way out of spec.
Right.
And so, I mean, they were the first ones that kind of proved the model in the space, that the best way to launch a brand is to build a paddle that's way out of spec.
Yeah.
You get a lot of great PR for being high spin. USAP, they'll kind of deal with it behind the scenes and they'll make them bring it in spec, but they still are able to launch their brands.
They got the initial.
They got the
right. Advantage. So a lot of our competitors, even to this day, kind of got their start.
If you look at their history, and so that's what's interesting. Kind of going back to your question is now there's like 500 brands, right? It's insane.
Yeah.
Like,
it's crazy.
And so we've seen that shift happen, and we know eventually there'll be a massive basic consolidation. But that's what made us invest, especially last year. I mean, I think it's up to 8 times we spent on R&D last year than we did the previous year. And it was for the purpose of, like, we need to be able to have very, very different technology. We've developed a lot of great technologies, but we need to make sure we're investing to be at the forefront versus just what a lot of these people do. They're taking manufactured factory technology and just implementing it. And they're not actually the ones developing. We actually have our own R&D team. We have our own patent attorney in-house. Like, he's on our staff. So like, it's very important to us to be able to have differentiating technology and invest in that, so we're protected long-term.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know if maybe should we talk about kind of the evolution of that, how like all these brands came in, and we do think it's going to consolidate.
Yeah.
That's going to go. Yeah. Really when the number of brands exploded was during the pandemic. And a lot of that was because pickleball went from being uncool to cool.
Yep.
And everybody was flooding in. And at the same time, interest rates were very low, money was cheap. And so we saw dozens of brands able to raise funds, go out. There was a pretty low barrier to entry. Anybody could go to Alibaba, find a trading company, buy some paddles and bring them on the market. And they would be, you know, not the best, but at least halfway decent compared to some of the other products on the market. And so very low barrier to entry, cheap money, and brands just exploded. So we think that's going away with interest rates being higher, money not being as cheap, and a lot of those brands failing. Investors are realizing, hey, it's not as easy to break into this market. And so we do think there'll be consolidation long term. Also with brands now focusing on patents, that's going to create some barrier to entries with brands that don't actually have real R&D.
Yeah.
They won't be able to create the top quality products.
Yeah. So at some point there has to be consolidation. Like, it happens in every sporting goods industry, happened in tennis, happened in racquetball. So the day is coming. It's just, you know, how and when.
Right.
So
I really want to hit on customer service, because this is actually something that I hear all the time when I am out in the wild playing pickleball, rec nights, all this stuff. There's a lot of people that complain about different companies' customer service. But one thing I always hear about Selkirk is people say, I love Selkirk's customer service. So can you tell us about, you know, your commitment to customer service and why that's so important to you guys as a company?
Yeah, I think it's kind of the whole do unto others as you would want done unto you, right? It's like I think we've all had experiences with horrible customer service, and you're basically like, you're just done with that company, right? So, I mean, we've had our ups and downs with that, just with growth and everything, but especially the last 5 years and our head of customer service, Andrew, does a great job running that department. We want to go above and beyond to make the customer happy, right? You're always going to get those certain people where it's like, okay, we're not making you happy today.
There's no way.
But that's very rare. And I think because we had that customer first mindset and really player first mindset, I mean, that's how we develop products too. I think it's just allowed us to build a reputation, and we've built systems too to enable our team to move really quick. Like, back in the day, it would take 10 minutes to process a warranty
or more.
And Mike built a system that took 15 seconds to like be able to like look at it, make a decision. So we're able to pump out, you know, any warranties super quick, efficiently, and not have stuff fall through the cracks. And then have a knowledgeable team that can actually answer technical questions. So.
And I think what helps is like we've both done customer service for our company.
Yeah.
So like, it's easier when you have someone like a lot of brands, as they grow, they'll bring in corporate suits and they might look at the numbers and say, this doesn't make sense. Stop servicing so well. Right. But like when we've actually done customer service, we talk to customers, we still regularly try to talk to customers and stay close. Like, it kind of gives you a different mindset. And we know that how important that is. And it's something that will always be a big part of our brand. I mean, if you look at Google reviews, like, we have 5 stars, I think over 1,000 reviews now. You don't see that with larger brands.
Right.
And that's something that sometimes gets missed and undervalued, especially with all these small brands that come in.
Yeah.
They make a splash and then, you know, they sell pretty well, but then they are gone in six months.
I mean, and you go through the Discord, I won't mention any brands, but some pretty popular brands right now, and their customer service is basically, they'll admit, is absolutely non-existent.
Right.
And so like, that's the thing, is like, we're building sports equipment, you know, hopefully nothing goes wrong, but it's sports equipment. You're banging against stuff. And like, if you have a problem, especially if you're spending money on a product like ours, we want to make sure we're there to back it up. So that's what's always funny to us when people have complained about pricing in the past, like when we're $20, $30 more, it's like, okay. But like, for one, you have a limited lifetime warranty. It's made here. And like, if you call us, we're going to answer the phone.
Yeah,
so,
right.
You know, if to you that's not valued, great, go buy that paddle. You have a problem, you ain't ever hearing from them.
Yeah.
So I think people realize that once you're in that situation, but not till, right? It's like a lot of things. So.
And you bring up a good point, because I'm sure that there's such a balance there, not just customer service, but also QC, like having that quality control. Because if you have good quality control and maybe there's less customer service tickets, then I feel like that's another pain point I've heard from people that have had experiences with other brands, that the quality control is just not there. They'll get a paddle that's defected, or it plays one way on one side and another way on another side, or the handle breaks.
Or you get one paddle and you like that one, and then you get another one, you're like, this is the same paddle, but they're totally so different.
Yeah.
So I've seen that, not just customer service within the Selkirk brand, but also just, we were walking through yesterday one of the facilities, and I was watching people do QC on paddles, like weighing them, writing down on the label, like how much they weighed, like looking at both sides. Like you can tell that you've really streamlined QC as well.
Yeah. That paddle gets looked at on average, or Selkirk or Selkirk Labs products made or assembled get looked at about 7 to 8 times before they go out the door. Mm-hmm. And one thing, like we were the first to do the limited lifetime warranty as well, which was a big deal. People thought we were crazy at the time, and we kind of were, like, it was a big deal. But what's great about that warranty is it keeps us honest. Like, we're kind of forced, it's a mechanism to force us to make sure we build good products that do have quality control. Because that product's coming back because we have a warranty, right? If we don't do that.
So. And so we've had a pass on designs, especially some of the early Gen 3, because just the nature of the design would make it to where you couldn't create a quality product. Like, that product is going to break over time. We just can't do it.
This has been so ironic about this Hyper Paddle. Obviously, you guys have seen some of the new tech we've been working on. And, you know, our whole thing is we're building, you know, we want quality, durability, and, you know, to stay in spec, right? And so we've been able to kind of break those barriers recently with our new R&D initiatives, where we've built product that's going to perform at the highest legal limits and give you a ton of other benefits from a performance standpoint and stay within spec, right? Mm-hmm. And so what's been very interesting about this whole Hyper Paddle phenomenon is you have people that are like, oh man, these guys were at the pinnacle of technology, like they're doing all this and that, and but then everyone's really pissed that their product's falling apart. Mm-hmm. And then you have that same brand within a year, basically their main emphasis is, we went back to QC, we did durability. So even though they're acting like it was the top performance, they obviously, from a consumer standpoint, had major, major, major issues where they had to over-index and emphasize that they're now doing quality control, right? So it's like, we didn't want to be in that position. Like, we want, you know, we have labs where we test stuff. So that's kind of where, like, if anything's going to go wrong, that's where you want it to go wrong, because we're doing small batches. But when you do a mass market product like that, you know, nothing could ever be bulletproof. But in general, we try to make sure we're going in with setting the deck the best we possibly can for us and our customers.
And for us, just the ability to react quickly is important with QC. So, like, especially on some of the lab products, like, it's not going to be perfect. There may be issues occasionally, but we'll always warranty them, and then we'll be able to react quickly and fix QC issues. It's not going to be an issue based on the product design.
Yeah.
What's kind of, I'm pretty ironic to us with some of the paddles that break in, is that the ones that marketed that technology weren't actually the first. The first were brands that like, I don't know if I should mention names, but Legacy essentially had the first, but it was seen as a QC defect. So they had to replace everything because they were breaking down and becoming hyper powerful.
Yeah.
And then the next brand said, like, oh, hey guys, we have this paddle that breaks down and becomes hyper powerful, and the defect becomes a feature.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So we don't want a defect to be a feature. Like, we want to actually build a purposeful feature that actually holds up over time.
Yeah. And we got the privilege of taking some prototypes out and hitting them the other day, some of the new tech that you're talking about that checks all three of those boxes. We were talking about on the way over here to this interview today, we're really excited because we really liked the way that it was performing on the court, not just with the power, but also with the feel, and it just felt super durable, which I know has been a big emphasis for Selkirk. You guys want to make paddles that aren't going to break down. And so I did want to kind of segue into talking about the moving target of paddle regulations. This has been a big hot button topic in 2024. Just seeing this, how it seems like from the outside looking in, I'm sure you guys have experienced this, but kind of almost being expected to make changes and pivots overnight to regulations, things not being clear. Tell us about some of how that's affected you as a brand, not really, or feeling like you're in the dark and that type of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's also like for some context, especially with USAP, like they have to deal with brands working around the rules quite often. I mean, we deal with overseas suppliers for SLK, and one of our hardest things is getting them to understand the importance of QC and being in spec. And what they'll tell us is, hey, you don't understand, this is how it works. We'll send you in spec paddles for you to send to USAP for approval, and then we'll create out of spec ones that consumers like more. And we're just like, no, we can't. We're not going to do that. So USAP is sort of like they've been working on their enforcement structure to make sure that brands stay in spec. And there's been a lot of cheating. It used to be mostly focused on surface roughness.
Yeah, and the thing is too, we're not talking about like borderline,
right?
You know, spec. We're talking like they're purposely doing stuff that's like 48. Like we're talking.
Yeah.
We're not talking like little margin. We're talking they're like building stuff specifically to be very out of spec.
Because all paddles will have some variance.
Yeah.
And you know, if the limit's 42, you might have some that are 38, some 40, some 44. And that's somewhat understandable. But I mean, we've had product that on like coefficient of friction, it comes out 7x over the limit.
So competitor,
not ours, but yeah, competitor products.
Yeah.
So but then eventually brands started becoming so bold as to not just cheat on surface, but also cheat on structures. And so that's where like some more of the messes come up. You know, we spend a lot of time making sure we're compliant. And so I guess maybe we have a little less grace when we see someone get caught, because we know how the rules work. They know how the rules work. They know sending it in to the lab for PB Core is enough. Like you actually have to send it in to USAP if you made a structural change. So it's like we sort of maybe see it from a little bit different perspective. That being said, like they have been working on changing the rules so that they have better enforcement, so that these hyperpower paddles aren't created. And the big difference is in the past, you're essentially incentivized to create a paddle that breaks in. So they would test the paddle up front, and then that was whether it was in spec or not. And then if it broke in and went wildly out of spec, that was fine according to the old rules paradigm. The new rule paradigm is they have a limit on the PB core, and the paddle has to stay within that limit. So it essentially has reversed the incentives to where paddles that break down and are not durable will sort of start going out, because you're now incentivized to create a paddle that's durable and kind of plays the same over time.
Yeah. And then with UPA, yeah, I mean, a lot has been said, so we won't really get into a lot, but yeah, we've, in a sense, stuff has on that, it has kind of gotten shoved down our throat. We were supposed to be on the board to help guide it. Never really practically happened. We were just there for, you know, centerpieces. And so we've just been, yeah, running blind and then expected to make these pivots really quickly with pros, and then being told this is only for pros, but then also like trying to shove it down the consumer, right? Which is just very confusing to the consumer. So yeah, till like literally a month ago, we didn't really know where we were at. Like we knew where our current stuff was at, but we didn't know where, like we've been working on all this new tech and we can vary it. And so we've just kind of figured out, like, okay, now we kind of know where we're at now. So we're able to kind of build accordingly. So that just makes it tough, because some of these other brands, right, that are smaller, they're willing to just take a risk and be like, I'm just going to shove this out the door. And then, you know, some of those guys have been running into issues or will run into issues where we're like, we sell way more paddles than anyone. We can't have a mass return because we're wildly out of whatever the new spec is, right? So we tend to be careful in that way. But what's great is we've built an R&D system that can pivot super quick now, because we've seen that this is probably going to be an industry constant. So we're able to basically get on top of these changes faster than anybody, develop product faster than anybody, and get that product at the highest performance limit while staying in spec and offer it to the customer. So that was a big incentive why we invested so much in R&D, was to have those agile capabilities so we could be at the highest performance level and not, you know, be perceived as being behind in some categories.
You two have obviously been very successful in business. I just wanted to ask maybe a broader question for anybody that's listening that is an aspiring entrepreneur, or maybe they are an entrepreneur, what is some advice you would just give to an entrepreneur?
You know, something we say a lot is focus on progress over perfection. You know, when you're getting started, like, there's going to be a lot of problems. You know, you're not going to be able to do things perfect. And so if your mindset is it needs to be perfect, like, you'll just not get anything done, right? I mean, similar, like, when you first get into content creation, right? If your mindset was, if I don't create the perfect video, I'm not going to release it, like, you would never release anything. So you just have to focus on, you know, I'm going to do the best I can today, and then tomorrow I'm going to do a little bit better. So that mindset of continuous improvement and being okay if things aren't perfect, but always focusing on getting a little bit better day after day is really the mindset you have to have. Because if you're a perfectionist, like, things are always going to be negative. Mm-hmm. Like, you'll never be able to go back and see, like, hey, yeah, maybe it's not perfect, but it's better than yesterday. And that's really what matters.
Yeah, and you have to get good at filtering people's comments too, and understanding that, like, not everyone's going to understand necessarily what you're doing. You have to be okay with the really high highs sometimes, and most of the time, very low lows. And so you just have to have kind of a temperament for that, depending on what you're doing, right? And like Mike said, action's the most important thing. Like, people I've seen that don't get anything done on the business side are the ones that just are constant procrastinators, and they don't just get in there and try. Yeah. Like, if you just get in there and try, and then like Mike said, try a little bit more the next day. Like, that's how you build companies, not having this brilliant idea. Ideas are a dime a dozen. Execution's all that matters at the end of the day.
You mentioned really high highs and really low lows. What are some higher highs or low lows that you guys have experienced?
I think COVID was a pretty low low. I mean, you know, you usually bounce out of them. You have to bounce out of them really quick, right? So this isn't like a week long thing. Like, usually it's pretty quick.
COVID was the only one that, like, lasted more than a day. More than a few days.
Yeah. You know, in the past, if we've ever had any, like, I'm the product guy. So if we have anything go wrong with product, like, I take that really personally and feel responsible. So we've had, like, you know, some products fail in the past. Thankfully, nothing major or anything anybody would even know watching this podcast. But, you know, years ago we'd have, you know, it costs us money, especially when you don't have a lot of money, that sucks. Yeah. And so, you know, that's not fun. You know, when you have an athlete that you were close with that kind of leaves or does something you don't expect, or someone that you work with in that circle of business that disappoints, like, those are usually pretty low lows. But, you know, in general, we've been very, very, like, all this stuff we're talking about, success and everything, like, we've been very, very blessed that we were in the right place, right time. God allowed it all to happen, and we had really good, cool people come alongside us that came to work in the business and help build the business with us, right? It's not like just us two doing this every day. Like, we have, like, right here, right, our whole media team and everybody, you guys, and, like, we've had just amazing people come alongside at the right time in the right place to help build the business. So those are obviously kind of, that's a really cool aspect that you have to sit back and understand and see and acknowledge. And then from, like, other, you know, high highs, like, you know, usually when we have a product, for me, we have a product do really well, or when, you know, we've had an athlete do really well and then the product does well. We don't have a lot of high highs, actually. That's actually part of our problem is we don't have a lot of high highs. It actually drives our wives and some of the people that know us close kind of nuts, because if we win, we just move on to the next thing. So that's actually a problem. So usually we only have lows, and then we win and we can keep going. Yeah. So, like, even when you asked that, I was thinking through it. It's like, yeah, we don't really do that. Like, we just kind of move on. If we win, we just move on. It's just kind of our personalities, I guess.
And a lot of times, like, the wins, it's usually, like, months or years in the making.
Yeah.
So by the time, like, we actually have the win, we're sort of focused on the next problem, the next thing. And so it's sort of like, that's cool, but, you know, we're just working on the next.
Yeah.
The next
so thing. That's more. And I think that has been what's kind of made us successful is we don't dwell on the positive stuff very long. We're kind of moving on. Okay. Now we need to work on why. Right.
We were talking to Tom yesterday, and he mentioned Selkirk having this 20-year vision. Like, why is that important to you guys to have, like, a long-term vision for your company or just for us people?
I didn't know we had a 20-year vision.
Yeah.
It just feels like, I guess what I'm saying is, it feels like you guys are very long-term, like, even what you're describing right now, like, being very, like, long, like, having your perspective be not just so narrow-minded, not just focused on 1 to 2 years, but like, where are we 5 to 10 years?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you even mentioned like advice for new entrepreneurs, and that's actually a big one, is like, you got to get out of the day-to-day. You got to be able to like see the trees and work in that environment, but you got to be able to step back and see the big picture and where things are going. And I think as a company, that's something where we're always looking years in advance. Where are things going? What's going to matter 2 years from now? And I think just being in the industry for so long and seeing so many cycles, seeing so many brands come and go, like we sort of have a sense of like, yeah, you know, we realize they're kind of having a day in the sun, but like it's not gonna last. And so we're always making decisions for the long term, and sometimes that means short term pain.
Yeah,
but we're usually pretty willing to experience that if we know it's going to pay off.
I think eventually. That's an advantage. We're able to think that way because we have no investors, right? And so we're mm-hmm. able to have that long term. I think the way we approach it, and the way I would say we look at things long term, is you have micro and macro decisions, right? And so we look at things as you have to do certain things, right, that get the job done today, yeah. and keep things moving forward. But then a lot of what we do is always, is this going to benefit the brand or be a negative to the brand? Is this going to benefit us long-term or be a negative long-term? And so we always kind of, I think we naturally filter through that filter, which allows us to make decisions that aren't detrimental to the brand. And when you do those small decisions consistently every day for 11 years, you know, Lord willing, you make a brand like we've made, right? I mean, it's simple things like I'll give you kind of like a solidified example is SLK and Selkirk, right? So we were making product in the USA only. We knew to expand, we had to make less expensive products overseas. There's just no way around it. They had got better at it. We didn't want to do that with our higher end. We wanted to be committed with Selkirk. So what a lot of brands would do is, I mean, especially if you were ran by an investment firm, is you would make a $50 Selkirk S paddle and offer it on the market, right? You get to leverage the brand. You sell more because people see the $200 or $250 paddle and they want to buy the $50 paddle, right? Because it's got the big S on it. And we just looked at it as that devalues the brand. What are we doing? What's the decision today? We want to build a premium brand. So if we want to build a premium brand tomorrow, what's the decision we have to make today to accomplish that? And that's why we founded SLK. We knew it would be short-term pain because we'd have to build that brand. You know, we had to associate it with Selkirk so it would have the cachet and could leverage some of that brand power, but then also be a clear, definitively different brand. So people knew they weren't necessarily getting a lifetime warranty, weren't getting the exact, you know, they were getting our QC and our knowledge in that product, but they weren't getting the Selkirk product. And so it took years to build that brand. And that's been a very successful initiative where we protected the core brand, kept building it, but then built a entry-level price point that people could have access to and basically now kind of have our cake and eat it too, right? But that takes, like, that'd be very, very hard to do today. And it was painful to do back then, right. But it paid off. So right. So those are the type of decisions we make from a brand perspective and yeah. what we do every day, yeah. if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think yeah, not having investors and sort of, it's one of those things like we know we're gonna be stuck with whatever we have and whatever decisions we make 2 years from now. Like we're not, we can't just walk away from it. So it's like when we see a problem or something that needs to be addressed, we just have to take it on head on, experience a short-term pain because we know, hey, we're gonna have to live with this if we don't.
Yeah.
Right. I feel really privileged to have known you guys and just see even a peek behind Selkirk as a brand. I'm really curious because I just respect you guys a lot. How do you each want to be remembered as a person?
I think for me, like the most important thing at the end of the day, like even though this, what we've done here is cool and great, like at the end of the day, like I want to be a good husband, a good dad, and a good friend, and honor God in what I do every day. And so this brand is at the end of the day temporary. Those are the things that are gonna last. So I want at the end of this experience, my kids to be, and my wife to be like, hey, he still spent time with us, took care of us. Yes, he had to go and focus on these things here and there, but like, to me, that's the win at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. So in 20 years, if that's the conclusion, that's a conclusion I want. Not oh, he built an amazing brand. Like that'd be cool. Like that, you know, but like that's the end conclusion I want.
Yeah.
So, because they helped us, especially our wives. Like right. They were a big part. Like we couldn't have done this without them, right?
So,
Yeah. And I think just to build on that, like I don't know if we rarely think about that. Like with the company, a lot of what we do, it's more like we just enjoy our job, enjoy right?
Do.
So even if it wasn't succeeding as much as it was, like we still would enjoy our jobs. And so it's not really about that for us. And I think our family and I mean, even when things are going bad, like it's nice to know, like we could go home and it's kind of a safe place and you can see our four kids and no matter what goes on elsewhere, like we still have that. We still have our friends, God, like that's not going away. So I don't know if we're too concerned about having a legacy or not. I mean, I don't know. I'm a little bit more cynical. I don't think people tend to get remembered, right? Unless you're, maybe if you're Alexander the Great, but.
Or Elon Musk.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, it's more what value you can build here and what with family.
And I think too, what value you bring to other people, right? Like I think what's cool, and not to disparage anyone that sells like printer inks, but like, you know, we sell something and contribute to something that keeps people healthy, right? We're not just selling printers or there's nothing wrong with that, but it's kind of cool to know that we're like doing something that's getting people healthy, getting people social, and we're actually like adding good to the world versus doing something that's just, you know, not really making a difference. So that's a cool.
We've always been very, we've always admired that about you guys, like just keep being able to be a part of this company, a part of this brand. It seems like everything that you do is built on your core values. And I know Danae had a big decision to make. Like she had some opportunities within the industry to go work other places. And she just came and she looked at me and she's like, man, I love Selkirk. And so it was really cool to see. And I think that she felt so comfortable like aligning with this brand because of y'all's commitment to standing behind your core values, like high level of integrity and just doing what's right. So we really just like thank you guys for that. And for like, it was really great to join forces with you guys.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that.
We really appreciate that.
And that's the kind of stuff we love. It means a lot is when we, you know, just being able to support, well, there's over 200 employees now. So being able to support them, I mean, that's another reason it's like, adds a lot of pressure for us. It's like, we have to succeed for everybody.
Yeah. And don't get us wrong, right? We are not perfect by any means. Like, we make mistakes every day. We are one thing that, and we sometimes have to temper this is we like to win. Yeah. So we're very competitive. And so, So, you know, we're, you know, by no means are perfect, but we try to do the best we can.
Well, we really appreciate you guys taking the time to hang out with us today.
Well, thanks for having us.
Great. Thank you.
It was a blast.